just join us while I was trying to get things started? Okay, good. We've got Bertha, who is just starting up a program. She's with a Winter's Advocacy Group in Los Angeles. And Daniel and Hope has been around for a while and has, I think you've got quite a bit of experience between the group here. We're in pretty good shape. We've got economic development in New Mexico. What we want to talk about this week is going to be funding sources. And before we get started, though, we want to look at a question that someone had last week. Is everyone there?
Yes.
Oh, okay, good. Good. I just want to make sure that we were wasn't talking to a blank group here. So one of the callers from the last session had a question, and the question was, how do we talked about certifications a little bit and getting people certified and all of the different certifications that go along with this program. And, of course, there could be 5 to 6 or 7 certifications that you might offer. And the question was, how do I get my trainer certified? And it's a little bit of a complicated question because the certifications come from a lot of different agencies. And we're going to have sessions that are just going to talk about certifications, and we'll zero in on that a lot more. But as an overview, you've got different agencies that certify, and you even have private sector companies or nonprofits that certify. And a certification is basically what people think it's worth. And so usually what happens, when you have a federal certification, of course, it holds the weight of the federal government, and they can mandate that to do, for example, to be on a waste site, you need to have OSHA 1910-120, that we call it the HAZWOP or certification. And they spell out very carefully what's in HAZWOP or who just joined?
Hi, this is Molly Dowling from OAI in Chicago.
Hey, Molly.
Hi.
We're just talking about, before we got started, about answering a question about certifications. We're going to have a program just on certifications, but it is in the eyes of the beholder and the employer. And of course, certain times there's state regulations or federal regulations that require, if you're going to do something, you have to be certified in some way, shape, or form. And it could be a state requirement or it could be a federal requirement. The general rule on anything is when the federal government puts out a regulation or a certification, states can be more stringent than that, but they can't be less stringent. So if the federal government says, if someone's going to go on a waste site, we want them to have this minimal training, there may be states that say, well, that's okay, but we want them to have more training because of our special situation in our state. It goes that way with all regulations. Who just joined?
Carolina from New Orleans Restoration Ministry.
Yes. How are you today? Even in environmental regulations, states and localities can always be more stringent than the federal government, but never less stringent. So certifications are that way, and there are certain things that the federal government has made certifications required on, and then some others they've left it up. They haven't gotten that far, and others they don't have any certification requirements. Often what they'll do is say, well, we've got requirements, but if the state wants to take over this program, their certifications trump the federal. So what we have is a kind of a mishmash. And within the federal government, each agency, of course, has jurisdiction over certain certifications. OSHA, for example, Department of Labor, because we're concerned about health and safety of the workers, OSHA is the prime on all the health and safety regs, which includes the HAZWOP or confined space. There's probably 50 certifications you can get from OSHA. Those are governed by the OSHA Institute, who has established those certifications, and states and regions can take over some of those responsibilities. But to answer that question that was raised of how do we get our trainers certified, if it's an OSHA regulation that has to do with health and safety, the first place, I think, the best place to go is to OSHA and the OSHA Training Institute. If you go to the OSHA website, they have a very extensive site about all of their regulations and certifications. And what they want to direct you to is to the state or the regional OSHA, and particularly the OSHA Institutes, big one being in Illinois. And you can go to train the trainer program and you can become an OSHA certified trainer. Yes, who just joined?
Clarice from Bucks County Community College.
Hey, Clarice.
How are you?
Good. We're talking about OSHA certs and how OSHA, at least for the OSHA regs, they govern those training certificates. Who can train?
Correct.
When it comes down to EPA, they're, again, a kind of a mishmash of responsibilities. They have the new RRMP, for example, is very specifically who, what curriculum do you need and what it takes to become a trainer. Is anyone out there an RRMP certified trainer yet?
Yes, OAI is in Chicago.
Okay, mm-hmm. Great. Who just joined?
Alex Torres with Winter.
Hey, Alex. How are you? Could you talk a little bit about the OAI certification? Are all your trainers certified over at OAI, Molly?
Quite a few of them are, yeah. I know that we went through a formal train-the-trainer process locally, and I think that was with IDPH, I want to say. Mm-hmm. And then we were able then to become certified to do our own train-the-trainer internally and trained quite a few trainers. And we have both a master, you know, sort of lead trainers and assistant trainers because it's a very small student-teacher ratio with the hands-on. And so we have trained quite a few staff members to be able to assist in that training.
Train other trainers and perhaps some
yes.
of these other people who need to get certified trainers perhaps could go to your program or contact you. And
yes, they could.
Yeah, I'm actually interested in talking to you a little bit more. It's Clarice from Bucks County Community College. So afterwards,
okay.
I would like to talk to you if I could.
Is it all right, Molly? Go ahead. Who is this?
Al Dyson in Memphis.
Hey, Al. Is it okay, Molly, if I put your email in the post-session notes so that if anyone would like to contact you about training their trainer? Now, that has to do strictly with RRMP, correct?
That's right, the 8-hour led RRP.
Right.
Yes, sure, please, no problem.
Right. What about HAZWOPR? Now, I'll speak a little bit about HAZWOPR. One thing that's happening is HMTRI, which is the group that is organizing these phone calls, they have an extensive program with the National Science Foundation, with NIHS, which is responsible for the HAZWOPR program. Recently, they're partnering with a group that awarded an NIHS grant recently, and I think they're going to be in a position to do train the trainer in HAZWOPR, and this will be coming up in the next 6 months or so, where we may be able to get anyone who's interested in HAZWOPR training to one of the HAZWOPR training programs with HMTRI and Pete. But that is another different set of certifications, which is the 1910-120, and we could go to that. Now, I don't know. Go ahead.
Oh, I just was going to back you up that we have sent our trainers to the HMTRI, Train the Trainer. This is Molly from OAI, and been very satisfied with it. Would highly recommend it. It's a comprehensive, excellent program.
They have
and,
a little camp.
Yes.
And now,
I think it's a 60-hour train the trainer.
Right. when we get to some of the other programs, there's sometimes you don't actually have to go to a trainer. You set up a curriculum, and you basically become the trainer. Only those that require approved trainers, they're mandated, and those are usually the key ones: the HAZWOPR and the RRMP. Asbestos is another one. Molly, do you are your trainers certified for asbestos also?
We are not, no. Again, we go to the state to become, if we have to train any new trainers,
right,
at the state level for asbestos and lead.
Right.
But we do offer a train-the-trainer for HAZWOPR.
Right. That's great. And so they may contact you also on HAZWOPR.
Okay.
And that's basically how it goes. Once you establish a capability like OAI has, you can then go and train other people. I think on the RRMP, as a matter of fact, I think the EPA even lists all the trainers out there. So you can go to the EPA site and find out who may be in your area that's training. Now, having said that, the question was, how do I get my trainers certified? Molly's program is very sophisticated. OAI has been in this business for many years, pretty much since the beginning. And they've been with the NIHS program, which is responsible for HAZWOPR. New programs, perhaps like the winter program Bertha has, or they're getting started, you may not decide you're going to do any training in-house at all. You may decide you're going to partner with someone who has certified trainers or has ability to get certified trainers to do the training. And often, people who are just getting started will go to the local community college or the local university, are two sources. Some go to local contractors. Others go to the county or the city, who may have certified trainers that are training their people. What are there any other people out there that don't use in-house trainers?
That would be the Utica Workforce Investment Board uses the MBCC College for trainers.
Are you fairly happy with that partnership? Is it working for you?
So far, yes.
Mm-hmm. You lose a little bit in terms of control, but then again, you don't have all that overhead and that amount of staff. And now, how old is your program?
Now, we are actually just starting the Brownfield program, but we do have an environmental technician training program that we have been running for about a year now.
Great.
And that's what we've been using MBCC for. And they do HAZWOPR, OSHA, asbestos abatement, and also some lead renovator certification.
Right. One of the things we discussed last week, the big ones, and we're going to, starting next week, we're going to start talking about the RFP. EPA is this time around for their new requirements going to require training in the OSHA 1910-120 40-hour. That's the 40-hour HAZWOPR, and then the RRMP. I've got some issues with the RRMP. I'm a little concerned that there may not be enough trainers out there. Who just joined?
Charlene Kamara.
Hey, Charlene. One of the things we're going to have to see if, and the other thing about RRMP is you may be in an area where there's not a lot of lead. RRMP is a lead health and safety and remediation standard, and if you're in a new area, they may not, and if it's post-1978, RRMP may not be applicable, and so it could very well be that you may end up, if you're writing a grant that says our labor market assessment, our needs assessment, indicated that we're really not interested, there's not that demand in our town for lead abatement and removal, so we're not going to teach RRMP. We talked to St. Louis last week, or 2 weeks ago, and they have a huge demand for lead because they've got a lot of old houses that are being rehabilitated and torn down. And whether it's weatherization or it's deconstruction or if it's just remediation, is going to be lead involved, and if it's pre-1978. So one of the things you might think about, and I think in L.A. you probably have those pre-78. Most of your urban areas have the pre-78. I'm not sure about like New Mexico and Gallup, whether you that might be as applicable. Do you have a lot of old housing in Gallup that might have used lead paint?
Hi there. Yeah, we have, like, that's probably one of our biggest problems because most of our buildings are extremely old.
Mm-hmm.
So, we have a lot of lead and asbestos.
So you're going to, in your grant proposal, that may be a key area.
Yeah, it's definitely a focus of what we're looking at.
Yeah. And you're going to have to look for trainers or someone certified, either train your own or find someone who is capable of training. And you could either have you thought about that at all in terms of who might do training for you?
Yeah, we're working with UNMG. They have a building materials program, I think that's the name of it. And the instructors there already have the certifications. Plus, there's an organization in Peru, which is very near us, that specifically targets Native American job seekers. And
right.
So we're kind of looking at the possibilities there of providing the training there. Apparently, as capacity.
Right. Great. Well, I think that's a good idea, and at least getting your feet wet and in your first cycles. And when you write your proposal, you'll probably want to be spelling that out and how you're going to do that and whether you do it as a sub-grant or contract to them. Well, let's move into a little bit into this area of funding.
Hey, Mike.
Yes, sir.
Can I get Molly's email address?
Yes. I'm going to put it in the post-session notes, but
okay.
Molly, do you want to give everyone right now so we make sure everyone online has got it?
Sure. It's MDOWLING at OAIINC.org.
Go over that again, please.
So, again, that's mdowling at oaiinc.org. I'll spell it one more time. MDOWLING at OAIINC.org. I'm sorry if it's a little confusing. Two I's in the middle of the last part of the email address. But, again, it'll be in the notes. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Molly.
And Molly is very modest, but she has a wonderful program. OAI is, I would say, one of the stars among the programs, both in what they've done in health and safety training, what they've done in brownfields training, and what they've done in other training. Sometime, like Molly, to talk a little bit about their program. They've expanded in all sorts of training and been extremely successful. And actually, this gets into the funding issue. When we talk about getting our program started, you've got to, first of all, of course, the hard part is you've got to start with no money and write the proposal, which means that you have to be attached to some other program because it takes a couple of man months, at least a full man month of effort split amongst a bunch of people, perhaps two, to write these grants. So if you're partnering with people, you want to start talking about splitting up responsibility. Of course, someone's got to be the key person when you write grants. It's got to filter through them. And we find the most successful programs is there's one person, and it may be very well be the person that's online right now talking. They're become the organizer, and they don't have to be environmental experts. They have to be good organizational people. And taskmasters, and what they need to do, and we're going to go through this in subsequent sessions, is find out all of the ranking criteria, all of the components that are going to make up your training program, and start finding out who's going to be responsible for doing those things. And then you've got to get them all together and then get them to start writing what they're going to do, how they're going to do it, and start having meetings. And, of course, at some point, this is all going to have to filter through you to put it into a concise document, because you're going to be the only one that really knows the grantsmanship, how to submit this grant, and how these are going to be reviewed. And, of course, clearly there's going to be there's several points. And one thing about the EPA RFP is it's other grants are written the same way. And if you conform to their approach, no matter who you submit grants to, you're going to do well, because they really require very specific issues. You have to explain it well, very concisely, and put it in a very understandable format. But it basically tracks through your whole program. Well, that part of it, that writing, really has to flow through one person. We find that when it doesn't, they sound really disjointed, and sometimes they don't answer the questions properly, and they get dinged for it. But that organizer doesn't have to be an expert in, but like I say, a good organizer, and also a taskmaster, and they have to really find out who's going to do what, and that with deliverables, and when they're going to be promised the deliverables, and make sure that they stick on time. Once you start to get funded, when we look at funding, we talk about federal agencies. Everyone thinks of the federal government, but that's the hardest money to get. As we go down the pecking order, it actually gets easier to get money, and sometimes the money is more sustainable. State and local agencies and local government is an excellent source of money, and some of our very successful programs have been able to tap into state reoccurring budgets. The people from New Jersey Youth Corps aren't here today, but New Jersey Youth Corps really doesn't need any money. They have too much already. They're into the state program. They're well-funded in millions of dollars. They've got a great program going. They have been in our program for about 10 years, and it was a great startup. But as they got going, they started getting additional funds, and they showed the value to the state and the region, and they're getting all kinds of funding on a reoccurring basis. Local agencies are the same way. Now, local agencies may or may not have discretionary funds, depending on. And even the states are in a very difficult position at this point in time, but there's a lot of stimulus money out there. What happens is the money goes through block grants to the states from the federal government, and when it hits the states, they decide how they're going to disseminate those funds. Often their grant proposals are much easier to submit, and actually the money comes faster, and actually the accountability isn't as stringent as usually the federal is. We have public and private foundations, trusts, and benefactors. We've had several programs that have gotten private money. The big ones, Kaiser, and they're very big foundations, Ford Foundation. Some of the grantees have gotten Ford money. They've gotten Kaiser money, but again, usually that's one-time money, and everybody's going for those funds. Private sector benefactors, they are a very good source of funding, but it's going to be different than money. It's going to be in-kind and technical, and we'll talk about that in a second. Community groups and nonprofits, we find that often there's a lot of groups out there, they're nonprofits, that have money to give to other groups. And you may have an organization that has to do with community development. It may be a nonprofit funded by the state. It may be a subgrant or a partnership with that community group. And then there's for-profit. And a lot of the, and I get back to Molly's program, while they're nonprofit, they're doing programs. They're not brownfields, but for example, didn't you do a program for Northwestern Hospital? Didn't you, Molly? It's unrelated to this, but it helps support your organization.
Yeah, we've done a couple of customized training programs like that for employers in the medical field, in manufacturing, in a bunch of pre-law, a lot of various pre-employment training programs.
Well, it's interesting because the skill set that you need to do a brownfields training program is the same skill set that you need for all these other training programs. I know at HMTRI a long time ago we were involved in development of curriculum, but we found that there were private sector companies coming to us that wanted us to develop programs for them. We did Safety Clean, for example, came to us and wanted environmental manuals, whether it be quality manuals or training manuals for their people. So all of a sudden we looked around, and the same people that were on our staff and in their idle time or spare time could do those other manuals just as well. And so you find that your trainers that are training in brownfields or in environmental health and safety, you may even be able to do a environmental training course or a hospital. A big field is the whole area of medical waste, for example. And you may find that you've got hospitals in your area that need medical waste training. And this is how a lot of programs get started. They may approach a hospital, and there's need for medical waste training, and then that's the seeds of their program. And they start developing, not thinking of it just as a brownfields program, but as the whole area of training. Now, in winter, for example, what you're thinking of doing in L.A. is similar to that, but a different venue, not medical, but you're talking about construction training. And there may be a need, a big need, for construction training, which you back into the environmental training, because you're starting to talk about weatherization. As you do construction, you've got lots of safety courses. Almost all our grantees have the OSHA General Construction Certification. And then if you're doing general construction, you might do confined space, and then you might get into the lead RRMP, and then you're backing into your environmental courses. You might get into the HAZWOPER, and pretty soon you've got a dual-track program that's providing construction skills but also environmental skills.
We are actually already doing that right now, which is funny because it kind of combines into construction and refineries and environmental remediation. Thankfully, we are already trainers in HAZWOPER and the general industry. We do have consultants that provide the RRP and also the asbestos. And the reason why Winter is doing that is because we want to make our – we are an advocacy agency for women, which is a little bit harder to place women in a non-traditional job, blue-collar jobs. And so we try to make them more marketable and valuable for the employer that we place them with. So it has been a task. It's been 2 years, but we're slowly progressing, and we're becoming independent every month.
We have a very successful program, Oregon Tradeswoman.
Yes, thank you.
We're in touch with them. Have you talked to the people up there? We'll put their contact information just in the notes so you'll have it. They've been very successful in working with women. And actually, we found in the Bay Area also, we find that many of the program participants are women.
Yes.
So,
this is Alex with Winter as well. We've been doing the environmental remediation training since 2005.
Okay.
Now we're combining it with construction and building trends, which in the past it was separated. We've been doing it for 14 years. Combining them both to make them marketable for the businesses that and the need of Los Angeles of retrofitting buildings. And
excellent. It's very natural for brownfields because you've got the skill set, you've got your organization together and your partnerships, and it's a matter of just now transferring it over.
To include the brownfields. We have been applying, as Alex again from Winter, we have been applying for
This is Daniel from North Star.
Yes, Daniel.
I have a question for you. For those programs that do not have independent training as of yet but plan to start doing it for the public, can you explain a little bit of how they go about soliciting individuals and companies to begin or start taking training classes from them because we have qualified trainers in our program now that are doing RRP now for our current class and are also one out of the very few who can do RRP training, both in English and in Spanish, in Connecticut. But and we do plan on opening up to the public because we see the need and also for sustainability of our program. Can they, those who have trainers, do have programs like that already going to the public, can they explain how they went about soliciting for us outsiders?
Anyone want to pick up that question? One of the things we talk about, and we'll talk about in another, we have a whole session just on marketing, but with two things that relate to that are labor market assessment and marketing your program. One of the things that you're going to have to do if you're applying for an EPA grant is a labor market assessment. And what that labor market assessment is basically gathering information about all of the people who may use the type of people that you would be working or training in your program. And it can be very informal. It could be a matter of going through phone books. It might be multifaceted, going through phone books, doing Google searches, looking at remediation firms. For example, if you're talking about RRMP, you would probably contact and find in the phone book every painter in your area. You could even do some searches, refined searches, find out all the painters. In Maryland, for example, Catonsville Community College, they actually got a grant from the state to find out all of the people in the state, all the companies, who may use environmental or remediation types of people. And they published actually a couple hundred page book on contractors and businesses in the state of Maryland that would use those people. They subsequently were able to use it in their training program. But what you want to do, and you just can't send out surveys. We found that surveys don't work very well. You get a couple of responses, and people say, well, we're not a remediation firm. We don't need anyone. Well, the people who need them are painters, welders, all of the construction trades. You're certainly going to have your remediation firms in there, but there aren't that many just remediation firms necessarily. It's the all the ancillary firms that say, hey, you know, we're doing welding on refineries, and we're running into asbestos everywhere. And the welder needs to be certified. And this is what will happen. They'll go in, okay, who's certified? Who's certified to asbestos? We got to cut some pipe up or weld pipe. We've got an asbestos situation. Your participants will be certified where the next person may not be. So you really, the first step is a good labor market assessment and finding out who would need the services that you have. The next thing, of course, is to put together some sort of a little brochure talking about the services. Now, a commercial firm, for example, I get every month I get faxed a little blurb from a company that does HAZWOPER and 24-hour and spill response certifications, and they'll just fax out to everyone, you know, here are our classes, this is when we're going to be, call us up or fax back to us, these are our prices, and they fill up their classes. And that's probably, I would say, the best. After a while, what's going to happen is the word of mouth is going to get around that you're the ones that can do it. And I think OAI is in that situation where you become the go-to company, the go-to place where people will look for you because of your abilities. Anyone want to add anything to that? Is that about how you all feel?
Actually, I have a different question. I'm the one that sent the email about, you know, asking how do you get your trainer certified. I'm from New Orleans, and down here we have different hazardous materials issues that arise. And we just want to know, is there, like, if they get certified in construction, is there so many different ways they can get certified to work with hazardous material, not to
one issue that we bumped into was when we wanted to volunteer as an organization to help with the oil spill, we had to go through a certification process that was only offered to the employees of the company. Therefore, it still left quite a bit of fishermen and other people out of work because they would be able to go work for the company. However, they weren't certified. And I'm just trying to see, would I speak to OAI about this, about what kind of different certifications there is in this area?
You know what? This is Molly from OAI. Yeah, you should get in touch with me because we have a local training provider in New Orleans, and we could talk with you about who offers a lot of the health and safety trainings that we offer, that we partner with all the time.
Okay, that's excellent. Thank you.
Yeah,
and what
great.
You want to do is then go to them, get your training, then go to the company. Now, one clarification. In the end, the company is responsible for the certifications of their employees. So what they do is they want certified people, but in the end, that company is responsible for the certification. So what will happen is you could go to Molly's training, get the OSHA, get the certification. When you're hired by the company, though, they assume responsibility for that. And what has to happen is the company basically has to accept, yes, this, we like the OAI training program and we'll accept their training and certification, and you become now under the umbrella of the company. In the end, the company is the responsible party, not OAI. So what happens is in the final analysis, and the reason that law is set up that way is different companies, you may, for example, I'll give you an example. We did some training at Pentax. Well, this is a top secret weapons lab. Well, they had everything. The phrase was, we have every known bad thing there is on Earth, and none of these things are in OSHA. And so their OSHA requirement was, your starting point was 1910-120, but then you went into much more extensive secret training on the base to handle these other chemicals. And for example, if they were in New Orleans handling a specific pollutant, that they may want to have additional training. The company may want to give you additional training. So, well, I guess to make a long story short, while you get the OAI training that gets you into the company because they're looking for trained people, they assume that training and your OSHA card, your training certificate, and they put in their records that you receive training and that, but they may also have some additional on-the-job training that you're going to get.
Okay.
Is that consistent with what everybody's found? Pretty much, your certs are pretty much accepted by most employers, though, Molly, I believe. Are they not? You have
yeah.
not run into an issue with that.
No, we've never had an issue. I mean, you know, sometimes it's state by state. So if there's state certifications, we have to get, you know, qualified in various states to be able to offer the trainings we offer there because we have programs across the country. But, yeah, everything that we offer is accredited.
That's great. That's great. Well, we promise to keep these down to 30 minutes. And, Molly, I want to thank you for being our mentor today.
I thank you. It's funny. I'm grateful myself to be here and to hear the questions and the resources.
You'll
hey,
probably
Mike, just
email.
One more question. You mentioned something about Brownfield RFP. When is that coming out?
Yes, that's coming out this month. And what we're going to do in the rest, our next session is going to be on the 13th of October. If for some reason your email gets blocked or whatever, it's always on a Wednesday every 2 weeks. So 2 weeks from now is the 13th of October, 2 p.m., same time, same call, same call-in. What we're going to start doing is talking about that RFP. It's going to be due in January, and we're going to actually go through all of the steps. Everything that's in the RFP is what you have to do to have a good program. So we're not doing calls to respond to the RFP exactly to tell you what to write. If you do some of the things we talk about, you're going to be right in line. And with people like Molly mentoring and getting ideas, and you'll know exactly all about this, and you'll be able to put it in words. And we find that usually people are pretty successful if they get a little bit of background in this area. So just hang in there and come on back, and we'll talk about
that. I definitely plan on being the call, but do we have any of the old ones from last year that's non-proprietary or can be stricken out?
Well,
like
we
a copy of what was done last year?
Yeah, I think what you could do is go to the region, and they can probably provide you with some. People are very reluctant to let those things loose, and you could also go to some old grantees that may provide you with some information. Usually that's kind of, people keep those pretty close to the vest. And one thing about it is every area is different, and EPA will... They do not like cookie cutter, and they will.
I'm just saying to learn. I know you're gonna have to be specific.
Yeah.
But, you know, sometimes
there might be
lot different than looking at something that was previously done. And
that's right.
Approved, you know.
And we're going to start talking about those proposals and what's going to happen. But basically, the schedule is the official RFP will come out in October. And it will have from October, November, December to write it. And we'll probably even have a special session on it over the phone. And then in January, it'll be due. And then it'll be awarded in early spring in time for next cycle in next summer. So that's kind of the schedule of that. But meanwhile, we can get our program started. And if we have a program, we can get it better. We could start moving in this area. And it's not like you submit the RFP and you start the program. The best thing to do is start the program and then get the RFP and keep it rolling and get it expanded, because you'll be a much better program if you do that. So, well, in a couple of days, I'll send you all the post-session notes and with Molly's email. And I've got a few other things in there that will give you hints on going after some funding. And we might, if you have questions, do what we did this week. Just email them in, and we'll put it out to the group and try to get you some answers. Okay. Well, thanks again, and y'all have a good couple weeks, and see you soon.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks again.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye. Bye.